language.
Hello, welcome to this Parliamentary Library lecture. I'm Roxanne Missingham, I'm the Parliamentary Librarian, and we initiated a series earlier this year called Parliamentary Lectures because we thought it was really important on issues that were complex and required significant information to be on the table for members and senators and their staff and other library clients. For rather than just to have our classic vital issues series of having debates, for people to be able to address us in a way which enabled issues to come out in depth and for us to see all aspects of them. This is the third Parliamentary Library lecture for this year and our second on the issue of stem cells, which is a very complex issue, and we decided that rather than just have one presentation on the issues relating to stem cell research and the implications, policy implications, we would have a series so that we could get a lot of information. So this week we have two Parliamentary Library lectures and I'm delighted to welcome you to the first one this week. Our guest speaker today is Emeritus Professor Jack Martin. Professor Martin is Emeritus Professor of Medicine at the University of Melbourne and a John Holt Fellow at St Vincent's Institute of Medical Research. He has a long and distinguished career at the University of Sheffield and the University of Melbourne. He was Director of St Vincent's Institute of Medical Research from 1998 until 2002, and his research has been in bone cell biology, the mechanisms of the action of hormones that influence bone and calcium metabolism, intercellular communication in bone and differentiation of bone cells, and the effects of cancer upon the skeleton. In addition to having a very distinguished academic and research career, he's a Fellow of the Royal Society and of the Australian Academy of Science, and has been President of the International Bone and Mineral Society, and is currently Vice President of the International Cancer and Bone Society. He has been distinguished as well for winning a number of awards and medals, and has also a very strong record of scholarly publication, and has been quite a significant contributor to discussion about the issues relating to stem cell research, bringing to them a great deal of scientific understanding and knowledge. So I would like you to welcome Professor Martin to speak to us today.
Thank you very much, Roxanne, and thank you for the invitation to come and give this parliamentary lecture on a topic which is certainly creating a great deal of interest and I guess will hot up over the next month or so. What I propose to do is, I think it's necessary to spend a few minutes, maybe 7 or 8 minutes, just by way of introduction on not just the specific issue that we're talking about, which is really therapeutic cloning or somatic cell nuclear transfer, as it's often called, but to introduce it by going over what is the background for that, what are embryonic stem cells, how do you get them, and what are claimed about them. Because although many of you will know, and there'll be some that won't, and if they could just abide with us for a little while. If we begin with what are embryonic stem cells in the first place. In early development, after the sperm enters the egg and the two cells fuse, in the very early days of development, one reaches the stage of what is called the blastocyst, with this little mass of cells, which in the human pregnancy is about 5 to 7 days. This little mass of cells inside the wall, and if one can either leave the blastocyst to continue to develop to an embryo and eventually be delivered, or one can take cells out of that inner cell mass and culture them. And this was done first with mouse cells in the late 1990s. And those cells were found to have really very, very interesting properties if they were maintained in culture. What those interesting properties were that they could be constrained to, they were pluripotent. They were capable of being directed towards, eventually it was shown, towards maybe every cell, any special cell in the body. And that's illustrated diagrammatically here, that these cultured embryonic stem cells are called pluripotent. They've got another very important property, which is they are called immortal because they can replicate themselves essentially as long as they're maintained carefully in culture. So they will grow forever, let's say, and they can be constrained, if one plays with the culture conditions, to become certain cells of the body. For example, I've got down the bottom bone marrow, nerve cells, heart muscle cells, or pancreatic islet cells. And it was this sort of property that made them a subject of great interest. Maybe they could be constrained to become special cells that could be used in treatments. Now, I'm going to come back to the properties of them as we go on, but certain of these properties raise problems within themselves. Their very pluripotency is itself an advantage and a disadvantage, because although they can theoretically at least become all cells of the body, it's extraordinarily difficult to maintain them in their differentiated state. And some cells are more difficult to generate from embryonic stem cells than others, particularly, for example, the insulin-producing cells from the pancreas. That's a very complicated cell. It's not so difficult in the rat or the mouse to make an embryonic stem cell capable of producing insulin, enough insulin to cope for a day or two with chemically induced diabetes in the mouse or the rat, but that's a far cry from really treating an experimental diabetes based on human diabetes. So there are problems that we'll come back to that complicate this and which have to be addressed in assessing what place they have. Now, because of these properties of being able to generate such vast numbers, what's developed over years is a great enthusiasm for what might be done with them in the way of treatments. Now, I'm not going to go into details about this list here, but this is just a list of the diseases that are usually talked about, predominantly in the press, that might be treated, might be cured, or at least treated effectively with embryonic stem cells. I'm going to mention a little later about Parkinson's disease and heart muscle damage and diabetes, but I've left Alzheimer's on this only because it so commonly appears in press statements about the promise of embryonic stem cells. But really, it's starting to disappear, but you'll see it maybe this week as a possible target for cure with embryonic stem cells. Alzheimer's disease is a diffuse disorder of the brain, which is the chances of any form of cell therapy ever being applied to Alzheimer's disease are so remote as to be not worth considering. And that's just not my opinion. That's the opinion of people who really do work on Alzheimer's disease. Spinal cord injury, I'll just mention, because that one is often talked about too. And there are some experimental spinal cord injury models, particularly in rodents, where cell therapies have been applied with the aim of trying to get the nerve endings at one cut end of the spinal cord marry up with the appropriate nerve endings at the other cut end. And using embryonic stem cells and other types of cells, including adult stem cells, but not necessarily even stem cells, that some temporary and partial repair of experimental spinal cord injury has been obtained. It's difficult to know just what the basis of that is, whether it's simply because cell therapy is able to help to put the what's called the myelin coating on nerve fibres to help them repair, and it's just a vehicle for the repair that takes place by the generation of specific molecules by the nerve cells. It's really unclear, but certainly if there is to be a place for any form of cell therapy in spinal cord injury, and that's by no means certain, then there's no good reason to suspect that it will be embryonic stem cells. That's just some preliminary comments about the diseases that are talked about as potentially cured or treated effectively by embryonic stem cells. Now, of course, There are, and it's been recognised for years, that there are a number of problems with just simply taking embryonic stem cells that one can get, let's say, from excess IVF embryos. And the problem is that if you are aiming to use them in treatment in human subjects, there would be the problem of immune rejection. You just take any old, IVF embryo, make stem cells, embryonic stem cells from it, then they will be immunologically compatible with the embryo from which they came, and the search for a good site of such cells would be an extremely difficult one. So immune rejection is a major problem which is not yet resolved and will take a long time, or take a very long time to resolve. Most importantly, and this is a point that I will come back to again and again, there is no experimental model of any disease in which embryonic stem cells of any origin have been effectively used as a safe, prolonged, effective cure. That's not just an opinion, that's a fact. There's lots of reports of partial effects and temporary effects of embryonic stem cells in experimental models. In no case is there prolonged, safe, effective treatment, and we'll come back to that. Thirdly, and most importantly, and this is often glossed over, there's a very high incidence of tumour formation with these cells. When these cells are transplanted into animals, up to 25% of them develop a tumour known as a teratoma, which is a malignant tumour, and this is something which has so far proven an insuperable problem. It's often, in discussions about it, it's often glossed over. It's certainly glossed over in the Lockhart report, and I'll come back to that. And this alone, if there were really compelling arguments, which there are not, for using embryonic stem cells in any human trial, this alone would be sufficient to militate against that human trial. Fourthly, and I'll come back to this, genomic instability. What do I mean by that? By that I mean that when embryonic stem cells are generated, the regulation of gene expression can be unstable, and that's even in ordinary embryonic stem cells. But as I'll show you, as I'll illustrate for you, this is a particular problem with the nuclear transfer method. I've mentioned the difficulty in obtaining pure, stable cultures. It's not very difficult to take embryonic stem cells, whether they be human or mouse, and change the culture conditions and get them to look like, let's say, beating heart cells. And that's fine. You're looking at the dish and you see the beating heart cells, but then over in another corner of the dish, there'll be neurons, nerve cells. These cells like to become other things. They like to divide and they like to become other cells. And that is a measure of their instability. So as a result of all this, there are no current clinical trials or treatments with embryonic stem cells in human subjects. That's a fact. There is actually one that's rumoured that'll take place next year or the year after, the US-based biotechnology company called Geron. And we keep seeing reports that they are planning human clinical studies. I can't for the life of me imagine how they could be seriously doing that, given, unless they know something that the rest of the world doesn't know about these cells. And I'd be interested, my colleague, Dr. James Shirley, is here visiting this building for the next 2 days, and I'll be interested to talk to him about it. He is an expert in the study of adult stem cells and stem cell biology. Now, given that you can't use embryonic stem cells, and you couldn't even begin to use it, what about the alternative? And that comes to the main topic of today, which is therapeutic cloning or somatic cell nuclear transfer. And that's what I'm going to consider. I'll consider it in relation to the Lockhart Committee's review, which is the aspect of it, which for the purpose of this discussion is the most important aspect of it. That is their recommendation that somatic cell nuclear transfer be permitted, therapeutic cloning be permitted, and certain other things that accompany that recommendation. So what is therapeutic cloning? Well, normal derivation of stem cells and development, in this case of a mouse, is shown on the top, that is use of sperm and egg formation of an early embryo and development of a normal mouse and development of what we might call normal embryonic stem cells. Now, in somatic cell nuclear transfer, SCNT, or therapeutic cloning, what is done is as follows. The oocyte, the egg cell of this, in this case the mouse, has its nucleus removed from it, which is a procedure that quite a number of people can do technically now. And then a nucleus is taken from another cell, and this could be a skin cell or a fibroblast or a muscle cell, doesn't matter a great deal. And that nucleus is put in to replace the nucleus of the egg cell. So that's an adult cell. It's an adult cell. Somatic cell, it's a somatic cell. It's an adult cell that's transferred into the nuclear space of this enucleated leg. And what has to happen then is that adult cell has to be reprogrammed. It has to have its whole function, its whole genetic function, the genes that it can make, rearranged by turning on stimulators of gene expression, by turning off repressors of gene expression. It's a very complicated genetic process, but it can take place. And you have generated then a nuclear transfer blastocyst, an embryo. And that is an embryo. And why is it an embryo? Because it can go on and form a mouse, or the first cloned animal was in fact the Dolly, the sheep. And that was exactly how Dolly was generated, by transferring a nucleus from, I think it was a muscle cell, into a nucleated ovum of a sheep, of a ewe, and generating an embryo which went on to the birth of Dolly. A very inefficient process. One out of 277 attempts was successful, but nevertheless it did so, and it's been done since then in other species, but not in human cells. So this is, in a sense, repeating what we've said already, but to introduce the idea of therapeutic cloning with human tissues. So reproductive cloning, which I've talked about in the mouse and with Dolly, nobody of any reasonable approach, whether it be scientists or politicians or people, believe that we should be attempting reproductive cloning in human subjects. But what it would involve would be doing exactly what I've said, taking a nucleus from a particular person, then putting it into an oocyte from which the egg has been removed, developing an embryo, implanting it into a uterus, and allow it going through to pregnancy. That is, it's never been done, and it's we're told it's not going to be done, and nobody believes that that should be done. Therapeutic cloning, or non-reproductive or therapeutic cloning, has exactly the same steps up to here, but this embryo at this stage, instead of being used in this way, which is forbidden, the cells are taken from that, will be taken from that, and generating pluripotent embryonic stem cells, which then, by virtue of the way this has been done, would be matched to the patient from the person from whom that nucleus came originally. Almost perfectly matched, not perfectly actually, because the egg, the donor egg, has certain genetic properties, contains certain genetic material in the little energy producing particles in the sap of that egg known as mitochondria, and up to 5% of the DNA can come from the egg. So it's to that extent it's mixed genetic material. However, it's predominantly matched with the immunology, if you like, of the original donor cell. Couple of things to say about this. First of all, it's never been done. This has never been done with human tissue. It was claimed by the Korean, South Korean group of Dr. Huang and colleagues last year. They claimed to have established 11 cell lines using this method, shown to be fraud, and nobody else has done it. It's obviously very difficult, but probably someone will do it eventually. The only thing that's gone anywhere, the only group that's gone anywhere near it, is a group in Newcastle upon Tyne in the UK. And they've only gone as far as this stage, but not with an adult cell. They've done it with another, taking the nucleus from another embryonic stem cell. So nobody's done it, as far as we all know, in human, with human tissue, by transferring an adult cell into an egg from which the nucleus has been removed. So it's very difficult. Maybe it's going to be impossible. I don't think so. I suspect that if people tried, that will be done. The Hwang South Korean thing, achievement was greeted as great science. I don't regard it as great science, in fact. I think that if they'd done what they claimed they'd done, all they'd done was just manipulate methods that had been used successfully with other species. A bit of patience, try a bit of this, try a bit of that. That's my, if you like, a little cynical view of this. But if it is done eventually, I'd be very surprised if it's going to require great science rather than just simply technological fiddling with methods that are fairly obvious. It is possible that with human biology, that something happens when you take the egg out of the nucleus that doesn't allow proper reprogramming of a new nucleus that you put in. That's possible, in which case it might make it more difficult than I say. And the second thing to say about this is that this is an embryo. There are no two ways about it. You'll see people will be quoted in the press and all sorts of people go, oh, it's not really an embryo. You've just taken an enucleated egg and you've taken an adult cell and you've got a mass of cells that can be useful. Well, that is really a sophistry. Really, it's an argument that is mounted to suit your ends. There's no question that this, generated by the nucleus from an adult cell into a nucleated ovum, generated to the blastocyst stage, is an embryo. And it's that, this is a talk about the science, but I'll just make the one point about the ethics of it at this stage, that there are the legislation in Australia is that states that research can be carried out on IVF embryos that are in excess of those required for IVF purposes. Now, that was argued very seriously by these houses several years ago, and on a conscience vote that was passed. So the democratic process has established that that's the case in this country. And there would still be people who don't agree with that, of course, as there is with the democratic process. Now, what is being proposed is that a next major step be taken. And this really is a major step. It's quite a big step to go from using excess IVF embryos, which was argued would be destroyed anyhow or allowed to succumb anyhow, to deliberately manufacturing an embryo for the purpose of research. So there is a major ethical step involved in this, and that's why we're all talking about it, I guess. Now, what are the positives and negatives about therapeutic cloning? Well, if you make cells in this way that match the donor nucleus, you do have an unlimited cell supply for the reasons that I mentioned earlier on. You have genetic identity or genetic near identity. You have probably immunological compatibility. And one of the things you might be able to do, and I'll come back to make a particular point about this, and this is argued by many proponents, it could allow you to study cells from patients with specific diseases. You could take an adult cell from a patient with a specific disease that you want to study and make an embryonic stem cell line out of it by this method. I don't see that this is going to be anything other than blue sky research myself, but that's the argument that's put up. And there are other arguments against it that I'll come to in a moment. What are the negatives? It generates a new embryo. It's got this ethical, major ethical step that I mentioned a moment ago. It's highly inefficient. This one out of 277 attempts with Dolly is reflected in all subsequent efforts with other animals. It requires many human eggs. This is another aspect of this that's often neglected. That is the very substantial requirement of human ova, which more and more is looking as though these need to be human ova generated from women and, and used within an hour or so of harvesting, in other words, freshly obtained human ova, which presents extraordinary logistics difficulties, all sorts of difficulties. The cancer development I have mentioned, and most importantly, that genetic programming can be likely to be abnormal, which I shall come to. So what's the evidence required to justify the need for this therapeutic cloning or SCNT? First of all, we need, because this is a very specific step. We're not talking about stem cell research in general. We're not talking about embryonic stem cell research in general. Embryonic stem cell, human embryonic stem cell research can be carried out in this country under license. That's established from the 2002 legislation. And of course, one can address major issues, major questions in animal experimentation, and many, or most, maybe probably all of the major issues need to be expressed in appropriate, humanely carried out animal experimentation. So we need proof of concept of treatment in animal experiments. And by proof of concept, if you're going to mount an argument for the use of therapeutic cloning to generate human patient-specific cell lines, then that proof of concept has to be prolonged efficacy and safety. And that has absolutely not been done with any experimental animal model of disease, as I said a few moments ago. Secondly, you've got to overcome the teratoma or cancer problem. That has never been done. We're a little further in understanding why it is. It's something to do with the genetic regulation that is disturbed when the nucleus is taken out of an egg cell and an adult cell is put in. But it's there, it hasn't been overcome, and it needs to be if there's going to be any serious consideration given need to go forward with SCNT. One needs to overcome the instability of differentiated embryonic stem cells. Although it's possible to, as I said earlier, to direct embryonic stem cells along certain lines and satisfy yourself, that looks nice, I've got beating heart cells in the dish, or I've got neurons, they like becoming neurons especially, or I might even have an insulin producing cell. To produce a stably generated mature cell is extraordinarily difficult. To keep it stable, they like to become something else. And that's the experience. That's the experience of anyone working with embryonic stem cells. That maintaining that the stable phenotype of the differentiated cell is extraordinarily difficult. And for that reason also, putting them into animals and expecting that they're going to maintain that stably differentiated state is purely wishful thinking. This is an especially important point, the instability of gene control in embryonic stem cells, and I'll come back to that in a moment. And finally, the question, can disease-specific clonal embryonic stem cell lines work? Can they tell us about diseases? Now, everything that I've got up there can be done under existing legislation in Australia. There's nothing there that can't be done. They can be done under the existing legislative framework. Now I come now to the Lockhart review, because the two bills that are up before the Senate now are really just taking the Lockhart review and putting it up to the Senate. So what about the Lockhart review? Now one of the major tasks of the Lockhart review was to review the scientific evidence since 2001. Scientific evidence that might argue the case for the need for SCNT, for therapeutic cloning. Well, the fact is that there is no scientific evidence since 2001, and that's very clear from any reading of the Lockhart report. The only evidence that they were impressed by was, unfortunately, the Hwang Korean claim to have actually done therapeutic cloning or made some cell lines, which, as I said, the science was fraudulent. And it was discovered to be fraudulent about almost a week that the Lockhart report was submitted. I do think, under the circumstances, it would have been nicer if the Lockhart committee had in some way put some supplementary reporting. Maybe that wasn't allowed. What about the science since 2001? Is there any proof of concept? No, there's not. At the risk of repeating myself, establishing prolonged efficacy and safety in appropriate animal models of disease simply hasn't been done. Parkinson's disease has been studied quite a lot. Parkinson's disease is a disease which, certainly in its early stages, is fairly localised in the brain. It's a disease that damages cells that produce a particular chemical known as dopamine. And although cell-based therapies for Parkinson's disease as carried out several years ago have a really very bad history of extraordinary complications, What has been talked about is the use of embryonic stem cells in the treatment, implanting them into the appropriate part of the brain as dopamine-producing cells in the treatment of Parkinson's. There are animal models of Parkinson's disease in the mouse and in the rat, and in the last couple of years in the monkey, where embryonic stem cells by embryonic stem cell implantation has partially improved the signs of Parkinson's disease in rodent models. It's been very commonly associated with the development of teratomas, and in no case has there been prolonged efficacy. Heart muscle damage, maintenance of the differentiated phenotype in transplanting embryonic stem cells into damaged heart muscle has been extraordinarily difficult. Diabetes is especially important because, again, it's a disease that's talked about a lot as being amenable to embryonic stem cell treatment. Well, I don't believe that, and many of us don't believe that. We've spent a lot of our lives looking after diabetes and understanding about diabetes. Diabetes is an autoimmune disease in which the pancreatic beta cells that produce insulin are being attacked by the patient's own body, producing antibodies against that beta cell. Even if you could make fully differentiated, stable pancreatic beta cells to inject into the liver, say, of patients with type 1 diabetes, it's virtually certain that they would become the subject of the same autoimmune disease. Now, once again, there's an animal model of this that in which this can be investigated. Just simply causing chemically induced diabetes in rats or mice and giving them cells that can produce insulin for 48 hours is no test. There's a diabetes model in the mouse, it's called the NOD mouse, the non-obese diabetic mouse, which mimics the human type 1 disorder. It's actually much more severe, but it can certainly be used to test this hypothesis to prevent or ameliorate diabetes in the NOD mouse by the use of embryonic stem cells would go some way towards proof of concept, but none of that has been done. So, in fact, the Lockhart report, in talking about development of disease therapies using stem cells, they have to conclude, after discussing a lot of adult stem cell stuff, that since 2001, most of these trials, in fact, all of the trials, have involved adult stem cells, because at this stage, ESCL research has not reached the stage needed to start clinical trial, that is, proof of principle of a safe and efficacious treatment in animal models. That's taken out of the Lockhart report. Now, that's just a few comments on some aspects of the science as reviewed, or as inadequately reviewed, in my view, by the Lockhart report. There's further science that's been introduced in relation to the bills, and I put this up because on the website which puts the bills up, there's also on that site reference to eight papers that were tabled by Senator Kay Patterson on the 14th of December, on the 14th of September. Now, I don't know why they were tabled, because I'm not privy to that, but if it was to use them as an argument for the need for therapeutic cloning, or SCNT, then I'd have to say that not one of them does that. There are eight papers. The first one is a combination of gene therapy correcting a gene abnormality in a mouse with an immune deficiency making embryonic stem cells and putting that back into that mouse. And naturally enough, it was able to correct them. But you don't need, it's combining with gene therapy, which has its own problems, and you certainly didn't need to use embryonic stem cells. It was just an exercise. This second one does nothing to make a case for the need for embryonic stem cells. It was the report on an online journal by the Newcastle group in the UK that they had made a blastocyst by taking an embryonic stem cell and putting it into an enucleated ovum. It wasn't even repeating what the people from Korea claimed to have done. The third one was a paper which made a lot of press in Australia, a recent paper in Nature, in which human embryonic stem cells were derived from single cells removed from the 8-cell stage of human blastomeres. And that was 1 out of 36 they managed to do that. That's also not in any way relevant to therapeutic cloning. The fourth one is relevant to therapeutic cloning, and that's a paper in Cell by a Japanese group just a month or so ago, in which they've taken mouse adult cells, adult mouse cells, and they've identified a set of as few as 4 genes that they could put into those cells, and those cells took on properties that looked to be very, very similar to properties of embryonic stem cells. Now, that is a major advance. It raises the possibility, but it's the first such paper. It's only in a mouse. It's yet to be done by others, like any of these things, and it's yet to be done with human cells. But if that were the case, that this were a way of producing an individual specific cell without deriving it by the nuclear transfer method, well, that would take us, take the whole field a very long way. This fifth one was a treatment of Parkinson's in the mouse. And this is, again, along the lines I was talking about a few moments ago. In this case, there were mice that had chemically induced Parkinson's disease, and they were treated either with ordinary embryonic stem cells or with therapeutically cloned embryonic stem cells. There was actually no difference between the two, the effectiveness of the two in that paper, and that might just reflect the fact that the brain is a relatively immune-privileged site. But also, there were only 6 mice per group, and they didn't carry on nearly long enough to exclude the cancer problem. The next one is very interesting cell biology, but it really does nothing to the argument in this country for the need for therapeutic cloning. What they did was take out the cell of a mouse egg and put into it a cancer cell. In that case, it was a fairly primitive cancer cell, and that continued. But they continued to grow as a cancer cell. But they also referred to their own work, which I think now has come out, where they took a specialized cancer cell, a melanoma nucleus, put it into an enucleated egg, and it looked as though the embryo was developing normally. Now, that was very, very interesting. But the mice all developed melanomas. Now, this is very interesting cancer cell biology. It's got nothing to do with whether we need therapeutic cloning or not. This one is simply a failed effort to reprogram human adult cells by putting the cytoplasm, the cell sap of eggs, into those. But it's completely replaced now by the Japanese paper I mentioned a moment ago. And this, number 8, was, I have to say, when the rest, the other 7, I'm talking about facts, I'm just summarising what's in the papers. This is my opinion. This was a paper written by a young lawyer, PhD student, who simply uncritically accepted all that was contained in the Lockhart Committee report, and really, I don't think has much benefit attached to it at all. So that's scientific evidence since 2001. The second area of science that the Lockhart Committee didn't even consider seriously, in my view, was the problem of teratoma formation with transplanted embryonic stem cells. I've said enough about that without dwelling on it any further. Now, this next point is especially important, and any serious consideration of science by that committee or by anybody by considering these bills absolutely needs to take into consideration this problem of genetic instability of embryonic stem cells. Now, what do I mean by that? When the talk just describes again this process of cloning. In this case, we're using cows, so we're just mixing the species. But from a paper by Wilmot, who originally cloned Dolly. And in this review, and still asks the same question, can human cloning be made safe? Now here, we're talking first about taking through the whole process, that is reproductive cloning. Well, what happens with reproductive cloning? Although it can generate you an animal at the end of it, the incidence of abnormalities is extraordinarily high. That's really why only one of 277 attempts with Dolly was successful, and why there's such an extraordinarily high rate of abnormalities. There's a high rate of death in utero during early development, right throughout the pregnancy in any species you care to name, and a few survive. In fact, about a year or two before that, Wilmot and Janish, who's another big name in Boston, not far from Dr. Shirley, Wilmot and Janish published a paper, an editorial review, headed, "Are there any normal cloned animals?" Well, there's not many, but I think eventually Wilmot agreed that you could get some that appeared to be normal, but very few. Now, what can go wrong? In this whole process, what goes wrong is that genetic regulation is completely messed up. There's no simple way of putting it. Because what has to happen is that when you put an adult cell back there, it has to have repressor genes turned off and inducer genes turned on in a very complicated regulatory pattern. There has to be a process known as methylation of the DNA, and there are major changes that take place in gene production and therefore in gene expression. And in fact, Wilmot and now others have claimed that now that on the basis of evidence in a couple of species, if you actually look at surviving clones, that the genetic variation amongst those surviving clones is greater than the genetic variation of siblings generated from in the normal way. So that's a real cause for worry. And to think that you could make cells here at this stage here, to think that you could make cells and keep them as cell lines and have them completely free of genetic abnormalities is again extraordinarily wishful thinking, and most certainly it needs to be excluded, and it would be a very, very difficult thing to exclude. There are only a couple of papers so far that claim to, and it's a bit ridiculous really. They can take a panel of 20 genes and get no difference, and that tells you absolutely nothing. And in fact, it may well be that when you clone out, when you take a cell from a blastocyst that would, if it's gone on, predominantly been abnormal, you might select out cells that are better than others. But the genetic variation that you get in doing that is going to be very substantial. So for that reason, that's a reason that makes the whole question of the application of embryonic stem cells in all sorts of applications very, very suspect. Particularly, and one of the commercial, why our state governments are so interested in this is that they think it's going to make money by biotechnology companies, and that's why the big push in California was because it's going to make money. Well, the making money is part of it is because it's thought that it'll be possible to test for the genetic susceptibility to drugs, for example, genetic determinants of susceptibility to drugs. Well, if there's the slightest chance of genetic variation of the sort that I'm talking about, it would be quite ridiculous to be talking about using these cells in this way. For the same reason, if you wanted to use cells to study specific diseases, take disease-specific adult cells or adult cell from patients with specific diseases, make embryonic stem cells by this means, once again, the genetic, it's impossible to imagine controls for those experiments. The genetic variability, until this problem of genetic variability is sorted out, there's simply nowhere to go with that sort of thing. And this is in fact a conclusion from Wilmot. If the fate of cloned embryos is determined by molecular events within hours of nuclear transfer, and that's certainly true, it's disappointing that so little is known about these events during the development of cloned embryos. And during SCMT, a great deal is asked of the molecular mechanisms that have evolved to regulate fertilisation and pregnancy. Just finally, the last few minutes, maintenance of the differentiated state. I've said enough about it. That's a major problem. But this previous one, essentially not considered in Lockhart, and that's a serious omission. The maintenance of the differentiated state, no more than lip service. The supply of human eggs. The supply of human eggs is a really serious problem. What women, young women, are going to be allow themselves to be subjected to the sorts of treatments that would be required to produce an adequate number of human eggs if this were to go on. It's extraordinarily difficult to imagine, and it would be very, very difficult to justify. To suggest animal egg use, the hybrid embryo suggestion I really put in because that was what was suggested, but of course I think that the use of hybrid embryos is probably really completely pointless and fairly objectionable approach to this problem. Hybrid embryos are indeed hybrid embryos. You put a human embryo, a human cell into an animal egg, well, that's got a significant amount of animal DNA, and I don't know quite what one would expect and what one would hope to learn from studying embryonic stem cells generated in that way. So in conclusion, ladies and gentlemen, I have spoken, I think, fairly in some little detail about the science. I've focused on the Lockhart Committee report, which I certainly am very, very critical of, but that is the basis of the two bills that are up before the Senate now, and I'm very critical of those too. So thank you.
And Professor Martin's happy to take questions or comments.
I have a question. Professor Martin, Kate Patterson, was my bill, so thank you for your criticism. I have some criticism of what you said too, but anyway, having said that, when IVF was first introduced in Victoria, were you supportive of it or opposed to it, first of all? And secondly, are you opposed to the use of embryos access to IVF? Were you opposed to the 2002 bill? And if so, could you explain why?
I can't remember the IVF, that's in the early 70s. I have always argued from the scientific point of view, Senator Patterson. I got interested in this because I've been a scientist, a cell biologist, who has for most of my life been involved in the evaluation of science, whether it be in granting bodies such as the NHMRC and international bodies, or viewing for journals. I saw this as bad science. Now what you're asking me is, do I have any ideological problem that's driving me? Well, if I have any ideological background that would be compatible with what you're suggesting, then it probably would influence a lot of things I do in my life. But I'm talking about science, and you'll note that I didn't talk about anything that would provoke that sort of question.
Yes, thanks, Professor. Can I just take you back to the Japanese study?
Yes.
If I followed you correctly, you seem to be suggesting that what they had found was a method of deriving embryonic stem cells through somehow reprogramming or something, adult stem cells?
No, they reprogrammed adult cells. They were not adult stem cells.
Adult cells.
They reprogrammed adult cells by, what they did was they started off with a set of about 30 genes and they put them in and they got this behavior that looked like embryonic stem cell behavior. So they did combinations of those genes and got it down to four, and that's what they finished up with. Now, that's in the maps.
So my follow-up question, I guess, from that is, if the aim of somatic cell nuclear transfer is to produce embryonic stem cells, that's the ultimate outcome, some people would say as an unfortunate byproduct of that process is the destruction of the embryo, the kind embryo that's created. If the alternative to that, if a scientific paper is showing that there is some scientific promise in an alternative path to deriving embryonic-like stem cells that have similar characteristics, wouldn't that suggest that that is a line of research that should be pursued with some vigour before
alternatives
are explored?
It certainly would. And in fact, an editorial on that, in the same issue of that journal, by these two scientists from the Harvard Stem Cell Institute, who are really embryonic stem cell scientists. And what they describe this Japanese work as a significant step towards a rational approach for generating patient-specific embryonic stem cells that encumbered by neither the logistical constraints, which of course I've mentioned many of them, nor the societal concerns presented by somatic cell nuclear transfer. And that's actually a significant comment coming from them, but that's the idea. But of course, it's just been done by that group carefully, but just that group so far in the mouse, and needs to be done by others in the mouse, and it needs to be done in human cells.
I ask another question.
Yes.
With the Japanese research.
Yes.
When they production of what is an embryo-like cluster of cells, or if it were to be able to develop a primitive streak and behave like an embryo, does that pose questions for the further research? Because if it can develop into a cloned mouse.
It's highly unlikely. The way it was done, it's really difficult to imagine that could possibly happen. Theoretically, it could be induced to become an ovum, but nobody, I think, in their right minds would do that. But what you're suggesting is whether it could become go to the primitive streak stage. That's on the cell biology basis. That just simply doesn't seem possible. And of course, this how stable the behaviour of these cells, all of that needs to be done, needs to be determined. Yes?
My understanding from Dr. Rathjen, Dr. Washer, arranged a session a couple of weeks ago, was the Geron proposed clinical trial in California. Was actually going to be based on the approved cell lines by the US government, which were grown on mouse feeder cells. And kind of my concern and worry is about the safety of such stem cell lines used in human clinical practice. And jumping back to the Lockhart review, when one jumps to actual clinical trials and the status of those stem cell lines going on.
Yes, well, certainly that would be one aspect of the safety, but there are even bigger aspects of the safety that would need to be transparent before Geron could do this. Geron were going to do this, first of all, I think 2006, and it's gone out to 2007. I think the latest is 2008, but with nothing published. I mean, we don't know what it is, why they think. Dr. Shirley might have a comment, but. We can't work out why they think they're in a position to make such a claim. It's a biotechnology company that's not been noted for its restraint in many of the things that it's done. Who knows why they're saying this? I don't believe. Personally, I think it's highly unlikely that they would have information that's not known to the rest of the relevant science world that would put them in a position to do any clinical study with human embryonic stem cells, however they were derived, whether they were by the FDA or any other procedure, because even if for no other reason, because of the cancer problem.
Except my concern is the specific on the use of US stem cell lines derived from that mouse feeder cells that have been purified suitably. Do you think, Geron's been reported out in Nature and Science this year as this trial taking place next year, and I understand it has been moved on. But my question is about the safety, the relative safety of stem cell lines grown on mouse beta cells that have been cleaned up with well, new US technology.
I don't think they'd be safe. Whether that aspect of safety is as great as the other aspects is an arguable matter. I think it's certainly an aspect of safety, but except there are bigger problems.
Except in the lockup recommendations, there's not enough, in fairness to lockup review, there's not enough detail to know exactly when they mean you can leap off into clinical trials.
Yeah, well, that's my point. I think if they're saying things like that, it's such a major step that they ought to be prepared to come out and tell us why they think they're in a position to say that.
Well, I think it's more at a regulatory level where these things are happening.
Well, the regulatory people aren't going to let things like that go through unless there's scientific evidence that's available for the scientific community. Dr. Shirley, please.
I would say the following, and let me just prepare you by saying this is going to be a cynical comment, but I think it's one that needs to be heard. Roger Kornberg just got the Nobel Prize, and he's the son of a Nobel laureate whose name is Arthur Kornberg. And Arthur Kornberg has said to biochemists, don't waste clean thoughts on dirty enzymes. It's a statement for scientists to recognize that it's important to know exactly what the facts are before we spend time thinking about them. And Geron is a company that's been around for a long time as a research company. They've had some serious problems with their investors as well. So what I would say at this point, that we really should be careful about wasting our thought on these pronouncements from companies about what they're going to do a year from now, because there are many motivations that have to do with business and investors. We have to really wait and see exactly what the FDA is going to allow. And I don't think anyone knows that right now, including Geron.
Look, I thought the talk was excellent, thank you. Just on a couple of comments that I've had made to me that I would like to run past you, when Alan Townsend, I speak to him, he said the teratoma issues that are now beginning to solve, so I'll run this past you as a statement, if it bounced back, so I'm not saying it wrong, I'm just telling you what he said. Because when they trigger the lineage and the various cell lines, if they isolate, which they can effectively do, I'm quoting him on the embryonic stem cells from that lineage, because you get contaminants of residual embryonic stem cells which form the teratomas. They seem very little in the way of teratoma formation. That was one comment, and I'll get you a comment on that. But I got you, so you know, if you can bounce back, but I'm just telling you what
it's yep.
The second thing, so teratomas are becoming reduced to debunks. The second thing is that the genetic dysfunction, the genetic changes, they're finding only in cell lines they've kept now for an extended period of time. So what happens is, as you say, the DNA breakdown, the genetic changes are seen in older cell lines. So certainly the immortality of the cell lines are there, as you stated. But to use these in an earlier stage, we're seeing far less of that beginning place. I'll get you a comment on that as a second one, because these are two major issues. But they haven't totally eradicated this, I'm not saying that.
Yeah.
They're saying they seem a lot less of a problem than they used to because of this. And the third thing is, I'm always fascinated, is this concept of embryo. Of course, you mentioned the National Health Medical Research Council, they do not consider a nuclear transfer as an embryo until the primitive streak is now formed, by definition of the council. And this council's made that decision since the lockup review, and that's openly stated now which is different from the sperm, I have been in the first mitotic division. So they've changed their definition, that is the National Health Medical Research Council. As a medical doctor, I find it fascinating, I'll make this comment. I know of no mammalian life form that comes on to a full adult life form without a uterus. So unless you're getting implantation, there is no chance of life. And even then, as you and I both agree with, you're not always going to be that lucky then. So this concept of an embryo going to become a living, breathing creature at the end of the day is impossible without a implantation.
Absolutely. But what you're saying is that you generate an embryo, and it's an embryo if you put it in the uterus, but it's not an embryo if it's sitting in the laboratory. Well,
Sorry, with respect, I did not say that. I said full adult life form.
Yeah, well, no one's suggesting that you're going to make a brick. That's being prevented. That's not being allowed.
Be, you and I agree.
Yeah, not being allowed. But you generate an embryo, and it's an embryo. You're using it for some other purpose, but it's got the capacity to become a full life form. There's no question about that. If it gets you running implantation, all that's happening is it's not getting you to run. That doesn't change what it is. It's still what it is. Now, the first two things, comments of Chancellor's, well, the first one was that if he's got evidence that, that lessens the cancer problem, well, let's see it. Let's see the publication, let's see the peer-reviewed publication, which I certainly haven't seen. And it would be a very, very difficult one for him to establish.
So I only asked this one because I have not asked him to show that, but he told me.
And the same goes for his comment about the genetic changes. Extraordinarily difficult to establish and make any claim like that. And so without seeing something that's actually stood the test of rigorous evaluation, it doesn't mean anything. Yes?
You pointed to a number of problems involved in embryonic stem cell research and SCNC specifically. In terms of adult stem cell research, can you point to any treatments that have come out as a result of the multi-potency or pluripotency?
Sure, there are. I don't think there's much to be gained by comparing them. I think adult stem cells, particularly in the hematological field, have been very effective for many, many years.
But in actually that, turning a cell from one type to another type?
Well, there's argument about whether the so-called trans-differentiation can occur. But the possibilities of adult stem cells from various organs are very considerable.
I'm not talking about the possibilities, the actual standard treatments or even government hospitals.
Well, the only standard treatments, I think it's often it's said that there are 70 diseases being treated. Well, in fact, it's somewhat less than that, in my view, that are effectively treated, and they're predominantly hematological blood stem cells in treatment. There are stem cells from the marrow that are not blood cells that are used to put from a patient with healing fractures and that sort of thing, and that can be effective. And there are a couple of other instances like that, but it's predominantly hematological stem cells.
I guess the point I'm trying to make is that an argument is put forward that there are a lot of ethical concerns with embryonic stem cell research, which I mean, we can bypass that and just focus
on. Well, you can bypass some of them. I mean, for example, in heart muscle damage and heart failure, there are marrow mesenchymal stem cells, non-hematological stem cells.
Yeah. Well, I'd be interested to know. Are there any standard treatments based on that?
Not standard treatments. There's a number under trial. Apart from the blood stem cells.
Some research takes time. I mean,
yeah, sure.
Roy, could I just add one thing to
this? Yes.
What I hear in your question is something that I hear quite often, and I name it as misinformation. It's the idea that we need to have pluripotency for adult stem cells to be effective. And when embryonic stem cells first showed up, excitement around them is that they do have this problem of being able to give rise, as you heard from the presentation this morning, to many different types of tissues. But the idea that that's needed for human therapies is misinformation. I mean, what you need for each type of human tissue is an adult stem cell from that tissue. Blood is a great example. But pretty much all of our tissues have adult stem cells in them. And understanding how they work, how to get them out and transfer them from one person to another, is the way to approach human disease. The other problem is that the pluripotency of embryonic stem cells is, in fact, one of the things that underlies this tumor-forming property. Cells that have the ability to make many different things, that's what they do.
What about adult stem cells?
Excuse me?
Do adult stem cells have cancer-forming properties? If they can use
none that are known.
Stem cell.
No, none that are known. The kinds of transplants that have been done in the hematopoietic system, which is extensive. And also, even organ transplant, when you think about it, is also a form of adult stem cell transplantation. There aren't problems with tumor formation. And it's because of the absence of the pluripotency that the biology behaves that way. So the important message here is that pluripotency is not required to achieve adoptive therapies.
Well, that's not what you share my work out in the
The view may not be shared, but the information is as it is. These are facts. So there's a this connection there between what's being said versus what in fact is the reality of the situation. Billy Bogus has just been with us, and the media has just been propagated and promoted. Of course, that's why we're excited about embryonic stem cells, but you don't need it to do adult therapy.
Do you need it for stem cell research in general?
Excuse me?
Do you need it for stem cell research in general?
Well, I think people were excited about studying pluripotency. They want to study it in embryonic stem cells, but if the issue is whether or not this is going to be beneficial for people and treating disease, it's not needed.
That's your point of view, isn't it?
No, it's not just my point of view. It's a statement of how we understand the behavior of the cells and how we understand how human tissues behave. I'm an opinion, that's how the cells behave. It's just a misstatement in terms of what that means. And also my view.
All right, well, if that's the end of the questions, I might ask you all to thank Professor Martin again for his presentation. And just a reminder that our next parliamentary lecture is tomorrow, 12:30 in this room. Thank you.
I'm going to go to the cabin.